is Cool Science Radio. I'm Bruce Kasanoff. I'm sitting in for John Wells this week. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peek. So while narcolepsy is often brought up in jest, it's no laughing matter, especially for someone who has been diagnosed with it, like our next guest, Henry Nichols. He's had narcolepsy, which is intense and uncontrollable sleepiness, for half his life. Curiously, he also has insomnia, which is also prevalent for those who are narcoleptic. Nichols is a science journalist who decided to delve into the world of sleep disorders, and what he has found is stunning, including sleep apnea, cataplexy, sleep paralysis, and vivid hallucinations. Nichols joins us to talk about these disorders and his new book, which is Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. Henry, we're really happy to have you here on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
So Henry, let's start with the basics. What is the function of sleep? You say that you've asked many researchers and clinicians, and you almost always get a different answer.
Yeah, which is really interesting, isn't it, for something that we all do, and we kind of know what it's about, but the scientists are at the top of their game. They give different answers, and quite often they give the same answers, but they might give two functions or three functions or four functions of sleep. And I reach, I think, a conclusion they would probably all agree with, that sleep is performing many functions simultaneously. And we've got pretty good evidence for each of those functions. And then it's not performing one thing. There's no simple reductive answer to what sleep is for. But it does a whole bunch of things, and they're things like making neural connections, which helps cement memories, or pairing back on neural connections, which erase things you don't want to remember, that or perhaps superfluous information that isn't necessary to store. It might be replenishing neurotransmitters. The cells kind of get worn out through the daytime's activity, so they need to replenish their stores so they can communicate again the next day. There are lots of metabolites from all that metabolic activity. They need to be cleared away. There's a sort of bunch of things. Essentially, it's just keeping the brain functioning. It's a highly complex organ, as we know. It's undergoing loads and loads of activity during the day, and this is a very, very important state for it in order to continue to perform at that high level during the day. Sleep is absolutely necessary.
So I was reading something that you wrote, not in the book, but about the book, and you said, by surveying a wide range of sleep pathologies, I've come to see narcolepsy in a very different light, not as an isolated sleep disorder, but one with real and important connections to just about every other sleep problem out there. Can you talk about, your views on that?
Yeah. I mean, that was the idea of the book at the beginning, and I felt, this is usually the way you start out with a book project, you kind of, that's a bit ambitious to try to get one sleep disorder and connect it to others, and maybe it will be a bit forced. I don't know whether it is, but I completely convinced myself that this is quite a useful way to think about narcolepsy. So it's defined as a hypersomnia, which means there's a lot of sleep. And that, if people know something about narcolepsy, they'll know that. But actually, that doesn't really capture what narcolepsy is about. Yes, sleep intrudes on your daytime activities in a way you can't control. So there's lots of sleep in the daytime. But at night, wakefulness intrudes on sleep in completely the opposite way. So you have incredibly fractured sleep in a way that is really not dissimilar to the way a lot of people will be experiencing insomnia. And then there are other things that happen with, so you have both hypersomnia and insomnia with narcolepsy. And that's just how it is. And then there are a whole bunch of other things that may that are relevant with narcolepsy. So there's a sleep disorder called cataplexy, or a disorder called cataplexy that comes with narcolepsy. This is where an emotion will take you to the floor. All your muscles are paralyzed. It's the same state that your body adopt during dreaming sleep in order so you don't act out your dreams. Now, that occurs in narcolepsy as well. We have sleep paralysis, which is where you wake up, but parts of your brain are still in rapid eye movement sleep or the dreaming state, mm-hmm. and you are paralyzed, and it is terrifying. And so narcolepsy turns out to be a very useful way to access and explore all these other different sleep disorders out there.
Yeah.
In a way, I don't think other sleep disorders can make those connections. There's something very fundamental about narcolepsy. It's a loss of some brain cells in the very center of the brain, the ones that regulate sleep and wake.
Right. Well, knowing what we know now about the brain and the ability to create different pathways and a possible workaround, that probably makes you feel like there's hope for someone like you. But I just have to say, I mean, Bruce and I were talking before we went on air about those college days when you'd have the afternoon class and there was just no way of staying awake, and it is tortuous. So I can't imagine, you know, not even being able to predict when that's going to happen. You know, we could predict it's a 3 p.m. really boring lecture that happens. But yeah, so I'm sorry that you have to experience it.
People with narcolepsy also have that downtime, but then it's just magnified. But there's very good reasons for that too. So this is to do with light and the body clock, and that period, just after lunch, maybe 3 or 4 in the afternoon, is when your body is goes into a slump before you get a reinvigoration towards the end that will push you through to bedtime. The way that light is something that we now really understand really well, the way our brains respond mm-hmm. to light, but it is something that people aren't taking very seriously in wider society, the way we hide actually during the day from natural light and then expose ourselves to artificial light.
Mm-hmm. And that creates these circadian sleep disorders. I would imagine that's at least part of that. And, you know, we talk about in this community, we've had the last several years, discussion about later school start times, recognizing that 7:30 a.m. is not the time that teenagers especially should be starting school. Their brains aren't even awake at that point. And yet, of course, I'm sure you know this, that there's always all this debate around, well, what about their after school activities and jobs after school? We have to start at 7:30 to fit everything in. But talk about the disservice that we are doing to young people, for example, disrupting their circadian rhythm.
Yeah, I really think so. The evidence is overwhelming, and we've known it for now 30, 35 years, that there is a clear physiological shift, like a time travel in the teenage brain. We don't really know why, but at puberty, the teenage brain will shift to a time zone that it is running about 2 hours behind the adult world, which means if you try and wake up a child at 6 to make that school start time of 7:30, this is like an adult being asked to wake up at 4. It feels pretty much like that. Mm-hmm. And it's no surprise then that children are, in the immediate term, struggling very much to concentrate and do effective work. In the medium term, it's putting them at high risk of mental health disorders. And that I think, is really not quantified in any proper way. And then there's I suppose in the short term too, I should say, one of the most devastating impacts is car crashes. In the older children that are already now driving to school, there is a very higher rate of car crashes as a result of falling asleep, because the children are at the lowest biological point. So this is the start time is one thing. Changing start times on its own is only part of the solution. It has to be accompanied by careful use of light in the evenings. If children are shifting start times to a later start time, they will probably just go to bed later and later and later if they are using those hours of darkness in the evening with screens and tablets and bright blue light. That right. has an effect of delaying the body clock.
So you have to look at the whole picture, not just the one thing of the start time. So we don't have that much time. I want to make sure we get to a few other areas. You wrote that all sleep orders have damaging effects, but the one that really stands out is restless leg syndrome. I wasn't even aware that that was a sleep disorder. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I suppose it isn't, in the sense that it's this uncontrollable need to move your legs as a result of an intensely uncomfortable sensation. I've experienced it once or twice, so I can vaguely remember how horrible it is. But it's very interesting. When people try and put it into words, they struggle very much. But it's so distressing that the only way to stop this feeling is to move. And it becomes then a sleep disorder because you can't sleep and move. So someone trying to get to sleep but with this feeling will have to get up, will have to move, and they end up being horrifically sleep-deprived as a result. So it's a very, very fast track to serious sleep deprivation. So in that sense, it's a sleep disorder. And it's really quite common and not very well diagnosed. And I think people with it live with it and come up with a system of coping. Do not go to doctors, or if they do, they get bounced away. They're not getting the treatment that is available, that is out there, that does work and helps for some people at least. And I think that message goes actually across the board for sleep disorders. People are living with aspects of dysfunctional sleep, a lot of people out there, and they just think, well, because sleep, I don't know, this is, they've just got used to it because it happens every day. This is how I live.
You said that, for example, there's two. You said people who have narcolepsy are much more prone to binge eating, for example. You said people with sleep apnea could also increase the risk of cancer. So is where you're headed that people don't understand that sleep disorders have other consequences that show up in devastating ways in our lives?
Yeah, they really don't. We give when someone dies, you know, the coroner will put a, they will say they died of a heart attack or something. But that heart attack, the underlying cause might be sleep deprivation as a result of sleep apnea, for example. So sleep deprivation. If you want the brutal message, sleep deprivation, which is all sleep disorders, or you trying to pare back on sleep because you think you can achieve more in life. So sleep deprivation on a habitual basis elevates causally, which means it causes an elevated risk of everything that can go wrong with the body. And we have the data to show it's obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, hypertension, cancer, all-cause mortality, which just means you're more likely to die sooner if you are chronically sleep-deprived. So yeah. It is very, very important to pay attention to sleep and invest time in it and take it seriously. It's quite a lot of work, but all the things that need to be done are very simple. You just need to sort of juggle all these things at once to improve sleep. And I think even people with good sleep who feel they get good sleep, it's always a project that we can work harder on and improve on. And there will be benefits.
And Henry, I just wanted, before we let you go, just have about 30 seconds left, but wanted to talk about the importance of recognizing sleep disorders in young children. We often think that they're just having nightmares, but when they may be sleep disorders, a really good point that you make in your book.
Yes, and of course, anything with a young child who can't quite express themselves yet is very difficult to diagnose. But there's some brilliant pediatric sleep specialists out there. And if you think your child is something, then you need to go and look for help, because catching them early and getting a diagnosis, getting help is crucial for that population in particular. Going through undiagnosed sleep disorder, it will have untold damage on your development, your education, and then your life prospects, your self-esteem, everything. So if you can catch it early, you will do that child a huge favor.
Okay. Well, thank you. We've been speaking with Henry Nichols, author of Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. Thank you for joining us, Henry.
Thanks, Henry.
Thank you.